Climate change, Cuba, marriage, immigration, economic inequality. Pope Francis weighs in on hot-button U.S. political issues. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Pope used his first direct address to the American people this morning to weigh in on deeply divisive issues. We'll talk about the politics of the Pope and the impact of his visit with our analysts today, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Hans Hassel of Cornell College. We'll also ask about Scott Walker's exit from the presidential race, the Planned Parenthood controversy in Congress, and Clinton coming out against the Keystone XL pipeline. Join our discussion for this Politics Wednesday. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, once again upon us. Lots to talk about with our analysts this week. Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Hans Hassel is with us, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, joining us today by phone. Hello, Hans.
It's great to be here, I guess, right?
You are here in the radio sense, as we all are. We want to invite our listeners to join our conversation as well. 1-866-780-9100. We want to talk a little bit later in the program about Scott Walker's exit from the presidential race. High-flying, especially at one time here in polls in Iowa. Now so far down that he has exited the race. We'll talk about the impact of that exit and what it says about the race in the GOP for the presidential nomination. The Planned Parenthood controversy, also the surge in polls by Carly Fiorina after that last Republican debate, and Hillary Clinton coming out against Keystone XL pipeline. A few of the things we'll talk about this hour. Well, this morning, Pope Francis immediately dove into the whirlwind of U.S. politics. He used his first direct address to the American people to weigh in on deeply divisive issues, including climate change, Cuba, marriage, immigration, economic inequality. The pontiff spoke in an elaborate welcoming ceremony on the South Lawn of the White House this morning. Here's what the Pope had to say with a nod to immigrants.
As the son of an immigrant family, I'm happy to be a guest in this country, which was largely built by such families.
Pope Francis also talking about President Obama's climate change initiative. Here's what he had to say about that.
I find it encouraging that you are proposing an initiative for reducing air pollution. Accepting the urgency, it seems clear to me also that climate change is a problem we can no longer be left to a future generation.
Okay, there it is. Climate change is a problem which can no longer be left to a future generation. Pope Francis this morning on the White House lawn. I want to reach out to our listeners in this first half hour especially. Tell us your reaction to the Pope's comments this morning on any number of topics. Perhaps you caught the live coverage, climate change, income inequality, marriage, immigration. What are your thoughts as you hear the Pope referencing these hot-button political issues here in the United States? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. You were listening, surely, Donna Hoffman, today. What's your reaction to the Pope's initial volley here to the American people?
Well, I think that maybe sometime watchers of politics may be surprised that the Pope is getting this much attention and kind of in a political fashion. Of course, he is appearing in the United States Capitol. But, you know, many of the things that he is talking about and is going to talk about for the few days that he's in this country, for the first time, I would add, are going to transcend what Americans are used to thinking about in terms of politics, in terms of red and blue divide or Democrat and Republican divide or liberal and conservative divide, because that's the nature of this particular pontiff. And I think that surprises a lot of people. You know, you do have the Pope addressing a joint session of Congress tomorrow. I believe the first Pope to do that. And he is going to, you know, talk to a chamber where we're, you know, people who watch are familiar with that setting in a State of the Union address, for example, where one half will stand up when the president says something they like and the other half may sit on their hands. And so it's a very political arena, but the Pope is going to bring his message there. And I think it will be interesting. A lot of people will be watching to see what he has to say. It's already been politicized because you have at least one member of Congress who has said they're not going to attend the speech because they don't like some of the Pope's positions, and obviously talking about those applications to American politics.
Mm-hmm. He has positions that please both Democrats and Republicans, or displease, as the case may be. We heard he supports tackling climate change, also reducing economic inequality that endear him to Democrats, those positions. But he also strongly opposes abortion and same-sex marriage, some positions that will make some Republicans happy. Hans, how do you see it?
Well, I think it's interesting. If you look back in our own history, ideologies were not so strictly adhered to within parties. I mean, I think that we have this misconception that abortion has, pro-choice has to go along with, environmental regulations, and in reality, they don't. And I think that we have this concept of right, something is a liberal ideology and something is a conservative ideology. And they don't have to be that. That's the way they've become in U.S. politics. And as people, as groups and organizations have come to work together, they've have been willing to adopt their collaborators' strongly held positions. But I think that right, Donna is right that the Pope is not situated within American politics. Right, his view is that those ideologies don't necessarily have to go together. And I think that. I think it's a good thing for us to get away from this idea of right that one particular set of policies has to go with another set of policies. And I think the Pope's ability to do this is very helpful because it will send cues to some people that may say, okay, well, if this person agrees with me on this, it's okay not to agree with them on that because this other salient individual in our society does not do that.
Mm-hmm. As Donna mentioned, John Boehner inviting the Pope to address Congress. Hans, we have these images standing or sitting on hands. Do you think the Pope will be received in such a thumbs up or thumbs down way as other politicians who speak before Congress, the president, for example?
I think that partisan politics makes it so that you want to cheer and applaud the things that support your own position. I think that it would be hard for you're going to get people that appreciate different aspects of his talk. With a president, when a president addresses Congress, it's primarily one side that's standing and cheering, and the other that's sitting quietly on their hands. In this case, I'm not sure that that's going to be. I think you're going to see an equal balance on both sides. So there's some things that Democrats are really going to like, and Republicans not, and some things that Republicans are really going to like, and Democrats not. And so I think that while we have this perception of this being a more liberal Pope, he is not. I mean, he transcends ideology and partisan politics in a way that I think that most Americans have a hard time grasping. I think this concept of recognizing climate change and not supporting gay marriage is a right. That's something that's hard for most activists and most partisans to fathom. Yes, I think you will see the standing and cheering, but it will not be a one-sided standing and cheering as it often is at the State of the Union or other kind of political addresses like that.
Pope Francis visiting the U.S. for the next 5 days. Donna, your thoughts on how much this matters in the midst of our election cycle right now as we're in the primary season for selecting presidential nominees?
Well, I think it might be a refreshing break from some of the rhetoric that's going on amongst the candidates. I mean, in the clip you played at the beginning of the show where Francis was reminding us that he's a visitor, he's an immigrant, if you will, coming to this country of immigrants. We've obviously had a very charged debate recently in terms of what some of the Republican presidential candidates are saying about immigration and policy and even American history in that regard. And maybe we can all take a step back from the partisan debate and listen to this Pope who's proved popular across religions, not just Christian denominations, but across even religions, and remind ourselves of what's really important in terms of talking to people and engaging in constructive discourse, which at least at some level we sometimes forget in the heat of a presidential campaign, and in particular a nomination campaign like this particular one that we're in right now, where there are so many outsized personalities and so just so many of them.
Mm-hmm. Reaching out to our listeners, is this a pope whose words transcend politics? Let us know your thoughts. 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about Monday's announcement by Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. He announced he's ending his presidential bid, and here's what he had to say about that.
Today, I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately. I encourage other Republican presidential candidates to consider doing the same so that the voters can focus on a limited number of candidates who can offer a positive, conservative alternative to the current frontrunner.
Scott Walker bowing out on Monday. Remarkable in that only a few months ago he was a frontrunner in the polls. Also here in Iowa, expected to prove himself here in the Midwest and go on from there. Hans, what do you hear in this? This was an abrupt announcement that I guess all but his inner circle were not aware of, even large donors not aware that he was going to step out this soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that his comments there in the clip that you just played are pretty telling. I think that Walker is among the slate of candidates that the party establishment kind of views as okay, as palatable and okay. And I mean, it seemed very much like he was saying, look, we need to unite behind somebody so that we don't end up with this disaster in Trump. We need somebody who will stay. We need to coordinate. We need to work together to coordinate. And I think that he realized that at some point that his path to the presidency was becoming much more rocky. It was becoming rockier and rockier as he tried to figure out a way where how is he going to get the nomination in a way that wouldn't not cause serious problems. And I think that he, unlike some of the other candidates in the race, has an incentive to be a good player. Right? There are I was doing interviews talking to people about Senate candidates and why people drop out of the race early on and right, why do we see this clearing of the field sometimes? And one comment that one former party staffer said to me is, he said, right, these candidates recognize that their path to the nomination or the path to winning the primary is difficult. And why stay in there and tick off a whole bunch of people that you're going to need someday, right? Why keep trying to mess up coordination and put a wrench in things and upset a whole bunch of people who may have a preferred candidate when you might need those people someday? And I think what Walker is saying is that he's going to get out now while he still has a political future and create an option for him in the future that maybe 4 years down the road or 8 years down the road, he can run again for president, or he can do other things within the party that give him access to power and influence in politics. And so I think that what Walker is doing is making a strategic bet that by doing this, he will be able to save some grace within the party and be perceived as a team player that may open other doors to him. And at the same time, right, facilitate coordination among the party so that they don't end up with a candidate that would be particularly disastrous in the general election, which is what Republicans really don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. Donna, do you see it the same way?
Yeah, he's certainly setting himself up for the future. He's only 47. He can run in 4 years. He can run in 8 years. He could run in beyond that. And notice how he, you know, framed why he was getting out. I'm falling on my sword for the good of the party. See what I'm doing? And
for a positive conservative alternative
exactly.
to the current front runner.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he very much is saving face. And he, you know, the question then becomes is can he put a decent amount of work into the state of Iowa, as we know. Can he continue to maintain those networks that he might need in a future race? He's from the neighboring state of Wisconsin. But, you know, he has through the through his little foray into presidential politics, seen declining fortunes in his own state. And so not only does he want to pay attention to the future, but he wants to shore up what he's doing as governor, because it won't help him in the future if he is written off as an unsuccessful governor in his second term. And so he was getting some grumbling, I think, also from the people of the state of Wisconsin that he was always in Iowa and various other places. And he can go home, tend to his business there with an eye down the road. And he's young yet. He's had a taste of the national spotlight. He knows about putting together campaigns and what not to do in particular, I think.
Well, there, let's go right there. That was my next question. What would you say are the lessons that Scott Walker has learned or should have learned from his fall from popularity?
Well, anyone needs to understand who's going to run for president, and we see this over and over again, that the national spotlight when you're running a campaign for president is unlike anything you've encountered before. And so people who are seasoned politicians can usually navigate that fairly well. Walker is pretty new to the game. I mean, he was elected in 2010 in terms of being governor, and he proved to not quite be ready for that very harsh spotlight and would say things that were pretty impolitic and then kind of equivocate and then back it up. And those are things that he's going to have to work on. It was also pretty clear that he had not done the work he needed to do, I think, in terms of foreign policy. He tended to shy away from that, hasn't traveled a lot outside of the United States, tried to kind of shoehorn some of that in. And those are things that if he has an eye to the future, and I think he does, then the people around him really need to help him with. And, you know, one of his former staffers, Liz Mayer, was active on Twitter in the aftermath of his leaving the race, which was one of the things that got her fired previously from his campaign, her being active on Twitter. And that was one of the things she pointed out, that he needs to surround himself with people who, you know what they're doing, who have his best interest in mind, who help him do the policy things that he needs to do in order to play on that national stage. And I don't think he was just quite ready for that yet.
Mm-hmm. Here we have this narrative of a union buster winning, I think, three elections in 4 years, if you include, which you should, the recall election for governor in a fairly progressive state, Wisconsin. Hans, why didn't this narrative work? Why didn't it punch through on a national level?
I mean, I think that it's national politics is very different from state politics. I think that Walker went from being a conservative governor of a liberal state to being a more moderate Republican in comparison to some of the other people some of the other candidates in the race. And I think that he struggled to create that balance of attracting conservative votes and also being acceptable to the party establishment. And I think that he was trying to walk that fine line that he was second choice to a lot of people. And I think that when you're second choice to a lot of people or third choice to a lot of people, mm-hmm. right, your polling numbers are not very high. And so he had this expectation of grandeur that didn't quite work out. He wasn't able to walk that line and attract the right people he needed to make his campaign last longer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is that right, he built up this huge campaign apparatus. He had a large campaign footprint that didn't match the money that was coming in. And I think that he could have restructured and dialed that down. But I think he said, well, it's rather than drag this out and make this and hope for a prayer, let's take a step back and regroup and we'll try again some other time. Do something else that continues that influence in politics.
Mm-hmm. What about that structure that was built up for Scott Walker, Donna, other campaigns snapping up those resources, those campaign advisors?
Well, I mean, certainly his super PAC still has money, apparently, and his super PAC had initially raised quite a bit of money. But the problem in today's presidential campaigns now with the presence of super PACs is that, you know, the super PACs and their spending cannot be coordinated with the campaign. The campaign still has to have money, and Scott Walker kind of delayed his entry even into the race, and he couldn't raise money for his own campaign, but the super PAC could raise money. And that in the end is something that, in hindsight, I think after this cycle, we'll look back and you'll see campaigns adjusting. You'll see campaigns mm-hmm. adjusting, I think, even now to that. But, you know, the infrastructure within the state, he put that together. It's a pretty personal infrastructure. And you know, quite frankly, in terms of will his exit from the race have much of an impact on Iowa, I don't really think so, because he had fallen in the polls. Now, he has those networks and those ties, but those tend to be rather personal. He suspended his campaign, which means he's not going to endorse anybody. Theoretically, you know, if we had delegates allocated, he'd still hold those, which we haven't gotten to that point yet. But nevertheless, it's really too early in terms of snatching up any kind of infrastructure he had, because he had some. But now those people are, you know, going to go back to this field of, what are we down to now, 15? And there's still 15 people out there to choose from, and Iowans look around and they mm-hmm. take a measure of people, and many of them decide late. And so that's kind of the state of play I would see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that Don is right. I think if you look at voters, yeah, there's still a lot of choices to consider. I think, though, if you look at major party staffers, potential donors, I think that those individuals, I think that the choice is much narrower. Yes, there are 15 candidates out in the race, but I think that they're divided roughly into camps, right? You've got the Jeb Bush and the Marco Rubio, kind of a more establishment camp. You've got the Chris Christie's and the John Kasich's and the kind of the more moderate group, and then you've got the conservative firebrands in Trump and Cruz. And I think that, right, looking where Scott Walker was getting his support and his donors, it makes sense that they would gravitate more towards someone like Marco Rubio, who is, you know, in the same sort of mold and same sort of he has the establishment connections, but is at the same time not a moderate in the way that Jeb Bush is. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what you look at. I mean, yes, I think that Don is right. The voters still have a lot of options as a result of this, and perhaps some of the voters that Walker would have attracted have appeals to a whole bunch of different candidates. I think that if you look at the donors and the staff and the kind of the where those major players within the party are likely to go, it's to those individuals that are similar, that are occupying a similar space as Walker was.
Mm-hmm. We're going into a break in just a moment, but briefly, Donna, this has been called the year of the outsider. So I guess a governor is not good enough to be an outsider anymore, even though we tend to think about it that way. We have people really outside politics, Fiorina,
well,
Trump,
you know,
and Carson.
Walker really tried to kind of bridge both of those gaps. He tried to be both establishment and anti-establishment in some ways. When he saw that the outsider status, you know, was going to be important, you know, he really emphasized the I'm not your typical candidate. I fought against the unions. And, you know, he emphasized that winner aspect. I've won three elections and you know, I know what I'm doing kind of thing. And trying to bridge that, what he saw as the being important in the electorate, didn't work out so well for him. And you know, at the end of the day, the electorate will likely come back around to a candidate that has political experience. We've not nominated candidates that don't have political experience. We don't elect presidents who don't have political experience unless you've won a major war. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, it'll settle.
Okay, we'll come back with more comments, analysis from Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Hans Hassel from Cornell College. We hope to have your input in this show. When we come back, we want to talk about the GOP's latest rising star after that debate last Wednesday evening, Carly Fiorina. Can you imagine her as the GOP presidential nominee? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of River to River Politics Day after this short break. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with this Politics Wednesday. Hans Hassel with us of Cornell College, where he's assistant professor of politics and associate professor of politics at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna Hoffman lending us their analysis to the latest on the political landscape. And there is plenty to talk about. In the first half hour, we talked about the Pope's visit and the politics of that, or the trans-political nature of the Pope's visit. In this half hour, I want to talk about what's been going on in the nomination process for each of the presidential nominees and the major parties. Want to have your input here, especially Republicans and independents this half hour. What do you think of the GOP's latest rising star, Carly Fiorina? Does she appeal to you as a presidential candidate? Why? Can you imagine her as the GOP presidential nominee? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, it seems like it was an eternity ago, Hans and Donna, but things moving very quickly on our political front. But the second GOP debate last Wednesday has yielded some new poll results I'd like to have you comment on. A new national CNN ORC poll out on Monday showing Carly Fiorina shot up to second place in the Republican presidential field on the heels of her strong debate performance. Donald Trump losing some support 3 days after 23 million people tuned in to Wednesday night's GOP debate on CNN. Trump still the party frontrunner, 24% with Trump, but that's an 8 percentage point decrease from earlier in the month. Fiorina ranks second with 15%. That's up from 3% in early September, just ahead of Ben Carson at 14%, though his support has declined from 19% in a previous poll. Also, when we look at people polled about the debate, 31% of Republicans who watched it said Trump was the loser. 52% identified Fiorina as the winner. I think, Fiorina, the consensus winner. The takeaways you had from that and the poll numbers we've seen since, Hans?
Oh, there's a wonderful Twitter account called Past Frontrunners. It's run by the Washington Post. I think whenever I hear poll numbers, I like to reference this. And at this point in 2004, Wesley Clark had a 9 percentage point lead in the polls.
Wesley who?
Well, yes, exactly right. Rick Perry in 2012 had an 8-point lead in the polls at this point, right? So, I mean, polls are nice, but at this point, but they're all a matter of media attention, right? When you're asked about an individual, who you support, most people are not paying attention to people's policy views, haven't picked up on cues from other people they trust about what these individuals would do in office or what their character is like, and so they're going off of limited information, and so it's a top of the head type response. And I think that this is exactly what's happened with Fiorina. The media perceives her as doing particularly strongly in the debate, and so they're going to give additional attention to her. And so you've got this kind of discovery of, oh, who is this person? This person's interesting. What are they like? There's some additional scrutiny, and then I think that people will pick up some of the weaknesses that Carly Fiorina had when she ran for Senate in California in 2010. There are things about her that as people start to dig, I think they'll pick up. Well, wait a second, I'm not sure that this is the person that we want in there. But right now she's enjoying that spotlight,
right.
And perhaps she can prove that to her critics wrong.
Well, I don't know if you might maybe giving the media too much credit here. She was poised. She was punchy. She was particularly hawkish. That would please many conservatives in the GOP. Here's her response on one foreign policy issue. Russia is a bad actor, but Vladimir Putin is someone we should not talk to because the only way he will stop is to sense strength and resolve on the other side. Donna Hoffman, what's behind her rise in the polls?
Well, if you look at what Hans was talking about, media expectations even. So she had been at the kids' table debate, if you will, in the first debate. She rose to the second big kids' table debate. And that was even remarked on going in. The media was talking about, she now has a chance to prove herself. She was prepared. She, did the things she needed to do. And then she's you quoted the CNN poll in terms of who won. Talking about who won and who lost a debate, especially a debate with that many people on the stage, is really kind of problematic. But it is the framework that we try to pigeonhole debates into many times. The media thinks the public wants to see, to hear that kind of estimation. The public responds. And so, Fiorina was kind of set up. It's your chance. Prove yourself. You're at the big kids' table now. And, she rose to the occasion, and that got a lot of remarks.
What about this question that Hans raised about whether she'll hold up under the greater scrutiny that comes with being a front runner.
Right. Well, again, if you look at past elections and you look at the flavor of the month, typically, and it usually is just about a month where you have these candidates. We saw it in 2012 with Herman Cain, with various other candidates, Michelle Bachmann, where they rise in the polls, they get some attention. They get more scrutiny with that. And with that increased scrutiny, they typically then have to talk more specifically about policy. Again, going back to the glare of the spotlight there, many of them aren't prepared for that. They make mistakes. They wane, and we go on to the next flavor of the month.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if either of you can tell me, what when you look at her record, and she did run for Senate in California, what parts of her record are most vulnerable to attack now that the spotlight has swiveled over to her corner?
Well, I think one of the things that was really problematic for her in the 2010 Senate race was her business record. And in particular, the way she and Donald Trump brought this up a bit at the debate. In particular, if she's going to run as a candidate that says, look, I'm an outsider, that's part of her appeal, I successfully ran businesses, then her business record is open. And that became something that she really had difficulty with in the Senate race. And I think that's something that, you know, if even Republicans are looking at how do you attack her as the front runner, if that's what she becomes at some point, then that's fair game.
Mm-hmm. Hans?
Yeah, no, I'm exposing myself as an outsider, but I was living in California at the time here when she was running for Senate. And I think Donna's exactly right that was a major issue in the campaign, and it was something that really hurt her candidacy. She had at one point leveled herself with Barbara Boxer in that race, and many people had this perception that she could win, and then Boxer went on the attack about her record at HP, which is less than glowing in some instances where she laid people off and raised her own salary. And I think that there are some concerns there, or there's some avenues of attack where she can be perceived as vulnerable. And part of this is that she didn't have a particularly good explanation for some of those decisions at the time. And she's had now 5 years to think about how to comment on those. And so perhaps she's better prepared and can give better explanations that will be more satisfactory. But her business record, I think, is one area, right? She doesn't have experience in politics itself, so it's hard to attack her in terms of her policies or her past actions or her past interactions in legislators or as a governor, but she hasn't had that experience. But her business record is wide open, and I think that there have been some very successful attacks, at least in the 2010 Senate race, that were influential in shifting voters' perceptions mm-hmm. of her.
So the playbook for her opponents has already been written and needs to be updated if they want to attack her.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And if she's learned anything as a candidate, as Hans mentioned, then, you know, she knows how to respond to those kinds of attacks now. That remains to be seen if she has good responses to the things that the campaign needs to know are going to come.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump. Up to now, for the past couple of months, the leader in the GOP for the presidential nomination. Are we seeing a turning point here in the last few days? I know it's hard to say, well, this will sink Donald Trump, though. His polls have gone down. This debate performance by Donald Trump and what's happened since, do you see, Donna, a turning point here at all?
Well, you know, if you would have asked me this summer about turning points, as one of my colleagues did, I would have said something previous that Donald Trump said was actually going to be the turning point. And I turned out to be very wrong about that. So Trump is actually kind of defying expectations. But again, more media scrutiny on him. And if you look at, you know, where he was silent during that debate, he was, you know, largely he backed off when they started talking about foreign policy. He still is not giving policy specifics. And at some point, the public will tire of the shininess, if you will, of Donald Trump, and will serious people will demand that he tell how exactly are you going to deport 11 million people.
And in foreign policy, if I can jump in here, too, you reminded me during the debate, he said something like, well, you know, trust me, by the time I'm sitting in the Oval Office, I will know about those things. Something along those lines, which...
That's exactly right. You know, I can put smart advisors around me and you know, and we can take care of it then. That's, I hope, with the American electorate, that at some point is not going to work. I have to put a little bit of trust in the American electorate that they will start seriously looking at candidates in terms of their policy positions. That doesn't preclude that an outsider couldn't do very well. But if you're an outsider and that's your only appeal, you know, at some point we have to start talking about politicians have serious jobs to do. The president has a serious job to do. It does take a skill set. Does Donald Trump's business skill set translate? He needs to prove that to us. And so far, he hasn't applied that to policy.
Let's hour is getting away from us. Let's talk about another couple of points in our political news from the past few days. In an interview with NBC for broadcast on Sunday morning, Ben Carson, the retired neurosurgeon, said, "I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that." And he was asked, "So you believe that Islam is consistent with the Constitution?" He said, "No, I do not." Hans Hassel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is obviously not in line with what the Constitution says, that there should be no religious test. But at the same time, there are lots of people within the United States that have specific views about the fit of someone's beliefs on their ability to perform the job as president. I mean, you saw this with Mitt Romney and Mormonism, right? There was about 25% of people that didn't think that a Mormon could hold political office. And so, you know, while his expressed statement is not in line with what the Constitution says, there are lots of people who use it as a cue for how people would behave in office. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really, I mean, the way he says it is offensive, but I think that many people would say, well, you can use your religion as a cue for what you would do, right? If you're Mormon, you're probably going to be anti-abortion. If you're Mormon, you are probably going to be right. You have a set of principles. If you're Muslim, what does that mean? What sort of principles does that mean that you adhere to and you believe in? And I think people would identify that religion with certain cues or certain beliefs, a set of beliefs that they might view as, you know, not compatible with what they believe in, what they want in a president.
And Ben, I would add here that, you know, Carson himself is a practicing Seventh-day Adventist. And some evangelical Christians, just like with Mormonism in the 2012 cycle, have issues with that. And I don't know that that's widely something that has been talked about much, that you know, this could be something that comes back to haunt Carson in that regard.
Mm-hmm. It certainly made other fellow Republicans in the race react to what he said. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush says he believes an individual's faith is irrelevant to seeking the White House or any public office. Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, said faith should not disqualify anyone from the presidency. Here's Carly Fiorina talking about that, reacting to it. She appeared on The Tonight Show Monday night.
You know, it says in our Constitution that religion cannot be a test for office. It is also true that this country was founded on the principle that we judge each individual and that anyone of any faith is welcome here. I actually believe that people of faith make better leaders, whether they're Christians, as I am. My faith has sustained me through some very bad times. Yeah. I've battled cancer, I've lost a child, I've been tested. But whether it's a person of Christian faith or Jewish faith or Muslim faith or other faiths, I think faith gives us humility and empathy and optimism, and I think those are important things.
Carly Fiorina talking about that. Also in the news, the Muslim theme continues with comments made by Donald Trump. He is continuing to experience the backlash from not reacting to someone at a town hall meeting who said the president was not an American citizen and was a Muslim. Here's Donald Trump making comments last night on The Late Show.
Barack Obama, born in the United States.
Let me just...
Was he? It's
you.
A meatball.
I know.
It's hanging out there.
I was just... And you want to know? I don't talk about it anymore.
You don't talk about it?
I talk about jobs. I talk about our veterans being horribly treated. I just don't discuss it.
You know
anymore.
That meatball is now being dragged down the steps of a subway by a rat.
But
right
I'm talking... You're right. You're
you
right.
Missed the meatball.
I saw that rat.
You
that
missed
was
the meatball.
Pretty.
You missed the meatball.
Now, Steve, I talk about jobs. I'm talking about the vets who are treated like third-class citizens. They're treated worse than the illegals.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the vets of this country are so mistreated. terribly. I'm talking about the military building up. Mm-hmm. Those are the things I'm talking about. I'm not talking about that.
Okay, so what do you make, Donna Hoffman, about Donald Trump's new take on his birther comments from previous election cycles that put him in the news so often?
Well, he talked about it a lot in the previous cycle. And so if he wants to, you know, say that he's pivoted on that, that's good. But, you know, he's talking about vets. Okay, well, what exactly is his plan? Again, I go back to an earlier comment that I made, is that, you know, he's got to start talking about policy specifics to prove that he's serious. If the birther comments weren't serious from, you know, the previous time he talked about them, then is he serious now? I think that raises a question.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk quickly about the Democratic side. Hans, how would you size up what's happening in the race for the Democratic nomination with Bernie Sanders surging in the polls?
Well, I think it's interesting that I think a lot of this surge has been the inclusion of Joe Biden in those polls, right? If you take Joe Biden out of those polls, Sanders' support doesn't increase a whole lot, but Hillary Clinton's does. And so I think that part of that may be a dynamic of some insiders saying, well, can we really trust Clinton? I'm not sure that Sanders is even the second choice here, that if something were to happen to Clinton, that they would look somewhere else, to someone else who would be more viable in the general election. But I think that, I mean, he definitely, I mean, I think just with Donald Trump, right, he has policies and statements that are very attractive to a constituency within that party, right? I think what Trump is trying to do is he's trying to say, I'm not going to go back on those comments, but I don't want to remind you about them either, right? So he's able to, in some ways, to continue to attract the support that he had, but without focusing on that and being able to present himself to others and make himself more palatable. I think Bernie Sanders is similar, right? He's appealing to individuals within the party, but he hasn't had that ability to shift to a set of issues that might be more acceptable. I think he's working on it. There have been reports that he's thinking about what that pathway to the nomination would look like, but we haven't actually seen that shift and that strategic appeal to policies that might be more appealing to the general electorate.
Hillary Clinton, the leading Democratic presidential candidate, has come out against the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, something she spent months avoiding taking a position on. Her announcement yesterday coinciding with a mass media event of Pope Francis's landing at Andrews Air Force Base. And during a campaign stop in Iowa on Tuesday, she expressed her opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline, saying it interferes with our ability to move forward on other issues. Here she is.
I think it is imperative that we look at the Keystone pipeline as what I believe it is, a distraction from the important work we have to do to combat climate change, and unfortunately, from my perspective, one that interferes with our ability to move forward to deal with all the other issues. Therefore, I oppose it.
Hillary Clinton yesterday in Des Moines, her two opponents in the Democratic primary, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, they've long opposed the Keystone XL pipeline, have been critical of Clinton's long delaying weighing in on it. Donna Hoffman, how do you read this and the timing of the announcement?
Well, Clinton has been holding back on deciding about this issue. And she has said, you know, look, the process started while I was Secretary of State. Respect for the Obama administration, she was going to hold off. And now she comes out and she says, OK, look, I'm against it. And again, it's addressing a key constituency within the Democratic Party electorate, environmentalists who have been dissatisfied with her non stance on this, if you will. And now she's come out and taken a stance. And, you know, she also then talks about, I think next week we'll be, you know, having a comprehensive energy plan. So, you know, she's going to be talking about that more if that's in fact coming and rolling
out.
But
if you want a lot of exposure in the media, you don't usually do it on the eve of huge papal visit, right, Hans?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a news drop to appeal to those people that are paying attention, right? The activists, but without drawing attention to those people that may not be, namely the kind of the moderates, the swing voters, the people that are less interested in politics that may have an opinion on this, right? So I think this is timed to get the attention of those people that care about it, but at the same time not draw a whole lot of attention to it, and in that way, right, be able to maintain some general election viability by, you know, putting this in a place where it's more difficult for those that aren't paying attention to notice it.
Donna, you wanted to jump in here again. We're about to close the program in a minute or so. comments?
Well, I was just going to say, in terms of the timing, it's, you know, kind of like having your cake and eating it too, in that, you know, you're satisfying a key constituency within your base that is going to be important in terms of you getting the nomination, but you downplay it in terms of the attention that it will get.
Mm-hmm. So along those lines of thinking, Clinton had made up her mind and was waiting for an opportunity such as a papal visit to announce it?
Well, I won't pretend to get in the head of Hillary Clinton, but certainly timing in a political campaign is important. And these are decisions that lots of, you know, people around the campaign table will strategize over. And so usually these kinds of things are not accidents.
Okay. Thank you very much. Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Northern Iowa. Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. We've enjoyed the hour with you, Hans and Donna. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks so much.
Coming up tomorrow, also you political junkies will want to tune in. I'll have a conversation with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. That's tomorrow on River to River. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon. In Cedar Falls, we had help from Tony Daner today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.